failure to not launch.
Rules must be binding. Violations must be punished. Words must mean something.
But missiles speak louder than words as North Korea claims it put a satellite into orbit to broadcast revolutionary songs back to Earth. The West says there's no satellite, only the threat of ballistic missiles from Pyongyang.
The world must stand together to prevent the spread of these weapons.
In space, no one can hear you scream. Heck, we can't hear ourselves think on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. Monday, April 6th. I'm John Hockenberry. Adora Udoji is away spending time with her new baby. And coming up this hour, we'll talk about President Obama's trip to Turkey and discuss a new experimental drug that could prevent memory loss. It's opening day in baseball, and we'll learn how to score the best ticket deals. Guess what? They're not in New York. Those stories coming up. First headlines. At least 50 people are dead after a strong earthquake hit central Italy early this morning. One citizen there spoke to our partner, the BBC, and said it happened all of a sudden in the middle of the night.
By the time I got out of bed, the stairwell had collapsed, so we had problems getting out, and you can imagine the total panic.
Rescuers are working to free those still trapped. Italian and U.S. measurements on the magnitude of the quake differ, but they go as high as 6.3. Meanwhile, President Obama is in Turkey, where he just finished meeting with the Turkish president. President Obama says the relationship between Turkey and the U.S. can be a model for spanning the East-West divide.
Moving forward, not only are we going to be able to improve our bilateral relations, but as we work together, we're going to be able to, I think, shape a set of strategies that can bridge the divide between the Muslim world and the West.
More on the details of those strategies in just a moment. Mark Garrison, what else is out there?
As John alluded to earlier about the North Korean missile test, the UN Security Council has ended an emergency meeting without agreeing on a response. The U.S., France, and Britain condemned it, but China and Russia urged restraint in a resolution. South Korean officials say the rocket landed harmlessly in the sea, but traveled twice as far as any other missile the North has tested in the past. South Africa's top prosecutors say the court won't pursue corruption charges against presidential candidate Jacob Zuma. He's faced the possibility of trial since 2003 when he was accused of accepting bribes to halt a probe into a French arms company. He's considered a likely winner in the election coming later this month. Also, a delegation of senior U.S. officials is in Afghanistan to discuss its upcoming election. U.S. Special Envoy Richard Holbrooke and Joint Chiefs Chairman Admiral Mike Mullen met with Afghan President Hamid Karzai and candidates for his office.
The Afghan policy continues to unfold, supposedly central to the Obama mission. We'll get more on that in just a moment. The Dow went up 0.5% on Friday. It closed at 8018. The S&P was up 1% to close at 843. Looks like a negative opening or a flat opening when Wall Street opens about an hour and a half from now. So we are talking about this story that's in the New York Times, our partners this morning. Scientists are working on a drug that could eliminate bad memories or prevent memory loss. Question for you. If you could take a drug to tweak your brain, what would it be? I would take a pill to blank my brain. Tell us your dream prescription at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Star Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Hey, folks, believe it, you have entered Monday morning.
Our government. Bailout. Your government.
Energy resources.
Healthcare.
Iraq and Afghanistan.
Global financial recession.
The work that needs to be done.
Rub your eyes. What's going on? That's the question we ask every Monday in our agenda segment. This week, the what, who, and where to watch. Whole lot to watch here. Obama looking forward to a strong reaction to North Korea's missile launch over the weekend. A visit to Turkey, a rumored visit to points east, possibly including Iraq, just speculation, of course, and a host of economic indicators out this week as well. To help us, we're here with Marcus Mabry, international business editor of the New York Times, and with Cynthia Gordy, Washington correspondent for Essence. Cynthia, good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Mark is, of course, our old friend right here in the studio in New York. Thanks, Mark.
Pleasure.
Mark, can I call you Mark? No, probably
yeah,
not.
Absolutely.
Your mother will be mad. So let me begin with the North Korea story over the weekend. We typically don't look back, but in many ways, Barack Obama laid down a line in the sand that we're going to have to see what the reaction is this week. It's very, very important.
North Korea broke the rules once again by testing a rocket that could be used for long-range missiles. This provocation underscores the need for action, not just this afternoon at the UN Security Council, but in our determination to prevent the spread of these weapons.
So a passionate, angry response from Barack Obama to the launch, and it seems as though he's saying the Security Council has to take action. Has he overstepped here? Has he kind of gone all in on the Security Council, which is known to maybe not take action, and there's China that's not necessarily supportive?
That's absolutely right, John. You know, this is a long-term problem that obviously predated this administration, but it's interesting the president's kind of passion there and kind of drawing a line in the sand that actually, without specifying what that line in the sand was, he talks about serious action. The UN did meet in a special session after that speech, and that resolved nothing, actually. It just said that this was a serious problem that had to be dealt with. Neither China nor Russia are actually going to stand up to any serious increase in sanctions against Pyongyang. And because it's such an isolated country, it's not clear what sanctions would be effective anyway. So it's interesting. I don't know where he hopes to go with this other than demonstrating his anger.
And there's certainly no precedent for North Korea paying a whole lot of attention to U.S. presidents. But Cynthia Gordy, is there a message here domestically of the president talking tough on this issue? And is that likely to play very positively for him back here in the United States?
And I think it'll play positively for him in the United States. But again, as far as being effective with regard to the UN Security Council meeting a consensus, I don't think that that's going to have much of a play in that strategy. Like Marcus said, they met yesterday and they couldn't even come together on a written response, like even a verbal response condemning the launch, because even Russia and China weren't comfortable with going that far.
But is the White House taking an opportunity here? I mean, in a sense, this is kind of the 3 a.m. wake-up call moment. I mean, this is what, Hillary Clinton suggested in the campaign rhetoric that, can Barack Obama say, yeah, definitely, I'm answering the call here. And is that what they're trying to project from over in Turkey?
Possibly. It's a 4:30 a.m. call, incidentally.
Well, we're glad to know we have another hour and a half. That's definitely. Well, the other thing is of course, Barack Obama is in Turkey, and it seems to me it's very, very significant, Marcus, that this trip, the first overseas foreign trip of Barack Obama, spends a significant amount of time in Turkey.
It's incredibly important. They said, and he said in his inaugural speech, he said specifically, and it was kind of extraordinary if you remember back then, he directed himself, he said, now to the Muslim world, we say, we are with you, we are not against you. It was extraordinary that he kind of directed himself specifically at the Muslim world. That had never happened in 230 years of American government. Turkey is an incredibly important key country. He came out once again, as other administrations have said, and this will probably, we'll hear the repercussions about this all week long, and said that the U.S. supports full European Union membership for Turkey. And that's just an incredibly gutsy thing to say, knowing that France and Germany, two of the largest countries in the EU, oppose that, at least in their current
governments. Well, let's remind our listeners, bringing Turkey into the EU puts the Armenia question on the table in Europe. It puts the Turkey-Greece tension on the table in Europe. And then there's all sorts of human rights issues that are definitely on the table in Europe. And Barack Obama has raised all of that.
Absolutely. And his point is that if you anchor this Muslim nation into Europe, that says more than anything else that we in the West are, in fact, as open to Muslim nations as we are to other nations. Eastern Europe had a lot of those same problems.
Right. Exactly. Well, Cynthia, does Barack Obama make points in the U.S. by suggesting that Turkey this time around will be a bigger diplomatic partner than it was certainly unsuccessful as a military partner for George W. Bush?
Well, I think there's some polls that have showed that the American public, even though they have a poor view of Turkey and the Muslim world in general, there is a push that people want to see more diplomacy between the United States and this part of the world. So that's a positive for him. And in addition to just getting along, there are mutual benefits to both countries cooperating together. You know, Turkey has interest in stability in Iraq, and we have a mutual interest, of course, in stabilizing that region and developing that region. So Turkey is going to be a really crucial ally for us, and strengthening that relationship is not only just a symbol of peace, but it's also a strategic benefit for us.
And we've seen already President Gül mediating talks on Afghanistan and helping to intervene in the Israel-Hamas situation, even though they weren't necessarily decisive there. You know, this is kind of out of the left wing, and I know the blood sort of drains from your face whenever I go here, Marcus Mabry. You'll get used to this, Cynthia, don't worry. I was annoyed with all the coverage of Michelle Obama in Europe. I thought it was just this kind of glitzy sort of Princess Di stuff. But it seems to me the ability to project this powerful sort of partnership and woman in a Muslim country has an extraordinary kind of side message from the administration. Have you thought about that at all, Marcus?
You know, I have, John, actually. So in this case, bless not
touchable.
But, you know, the fact is, when I thought the most powerful, and look, I mean, we've all heard the commentary. Yes, it's unfair that this incredibly intelligent woman who's had incredibly important positions, who's incredibly well-educated, would be judged in things like, you know, sleeveless shirts. Fact is, that aside, she looked fabulous all over Europe. That was extraordinary, and that meant a lot in France, especially a country I'm close to and lived in once. But secondly, what I found most powerful of her time so far in Europe was the speech she gave at that girls' school. That was incredibly moving.
Where she got really emotional. Yeah.
And she said, nothing in my past or in my roots suggested that I would arrive here as the first African-American First Lady of the United States. And that was a message to those girls, saying nothing in your past or your current roots can tell you what your potential and what your possibilities are in the world. That was extraordinary. And if she could...
To girls in the Muslim world, I mean, that could even be like 10 times more.
If you could see her with little girls in Turkey, and Turkey is an extraordinary country that's both very religious, but at the same time incredibly secular, it would be amazing to see her in that same purview there.
What do you think the White House hopes to get out of this Turkey meeting other than the president solidifying a strategic relationship, Cynthia?
I really think there's that partnership with Turkey being on the bordering Iraq, and maybe they'd open up to letting U.S. troops enter Iraq through the Turkish border, which is something that they weren't open up to again. But then there's just changing the view of the United States in Muslim countries. I think with the previous president, a lot of that part of the world thinks that the United States is an anti-Muslim country. So this is definitely a symbol to change that.
In points east, and particularly Turkey, there's a lot of concern over U.S. demand for imported goods and the turnaround of the U.S. economy as a leader for nations in emerging markets. Consumer credit is out on Tuesday, Marcus, and the international trade numbers are out on Thursday. How significant are those to watch?
They're very significant, John, because we've seen this tussle in our economic psyche over the last few weeks. Whereas on the one hand, the market has been responding pretty positively to the stuff that's been coming out. Four up weeks is kind of, you know, extraordinary. First time in a long time we've seen that on the market. So that's a positive economic sentiment going forward. At the same time, we saw those horrible job numbers on Friday, and we're going to see, I think, increasingly horrible job numbers. 5 million Americans are now unemployed and looking for work. The market and the economy are not sure if it's on positive ground or negative ground. We're right in the razor's edge right now. And these numbers are going to help us figure out, are we going in a good direction or a bad direction?
But is it safe to say that the consumer credit number speaks to demand of U.S. consumers and the international trade numbers speaks to a kind of cratering export market for companies that are depending on exports for profits?
That's absolutely right. That talks about international demand. That's been the future. It's been the growth engine for this, you know, extraordinary decades of globalization and increasing prosperity we saw. Will that be continued? That's the question.
And, of course, that is the question. Friday is Good Friday, the Easter weekend, so markets will be closed. Just a four-day trading week. My guests were Marcus Mabry, international business editor for The New York Times, and Cynthia Gordy, Washington correspondent for Essence Magazine. There's the agenda. Thanks, guys.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Continuing now, an issue that was brought up in our agenda segment. Joining me now is Dr. Gulnar Aybet, who's a Turkey specialist at Kent University in the UK. She's about to join the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington, D.C., and working on a book called Turkey and the Transatlantic Bargain, Time to Renegotiate. Doctor, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
It seems like an exciting moment for policymakers in Turkey and the leaders of Turkey, anticipating a visit by Barack Obama today and tomorrow, and also, with an explicit promise from the U.S. president to upgrade the bilateral relationship, although it seems as though the emphasis is on diplomacy more than military strategic cooperation. What do you make of Turkey's anticipation of Barack Obama's arrival?
Well, the anticipation is that obviously things have got to move away from this traditional U.S. Approach to Turkey since relations really soured after 2003 when, as you know, the Turkish parliament passed the vote not to allow U.S. troops into northern Iraq. And since then, there have been other things as well, the Soleimani incident in northern Iraq and the U.S. not really taking notice of Turkey's pleas to take care of the PKK presence in northern Iraq. Since then, the U.S. has really been approaching Turkey with a damage limitation policy and just trying to not really address the substance of relations. So I think what this could be, this visit could be the start of a much more proactive engagement with Turkey as a partner rather than a functional ally that's sort of useful at times of crisis, where the U.S. could just, you know, place a phone call to, but to actually proactively engage Turkey as a regional player. So this could be the beginning of that.
Well, I want to remind our listeners, the PKK, of course, the acronym you use there is the acronym for the Kurdish nationalist movement that is opposed to the Turkish presence in eastern Turkey and is declared as a terrorist organization by the Turkish government traditionally and has long been a security issue in the situation in northern Iraq. But I just wanted to remind people of that detail. Listen to this statement from President Obama speaking in Prague about his anticipated travel to Ankara. And then just let me know what you think of the issue of Turkish membership in the EU.
The United States and Europe must approach Muslims as our friends, neighbors, and partners in fighting injustice, intolerance, and violence, forging a relationship based on mutual respect and mutual interest. Moving forward towards Turkish membership in the EU would be an important signal of your commitment to this agenda and ensure that we continue to anchor Turkey firmly in Europe.
Dr. Aybet, now the membership of Turkey in the EU has typically been bogged down on a lot of issues, bilateral tensions with Greece, questions of Armenia, etc. By casting this as an embrace by Europe of the Muslim world, has Barack Obama changed the game here?
Not really. I mean, the United States has been supporting Turkey's application to the EU for some time now. And again, for the same reasons that it would be important to have a country with a predominantly Islamic population in Europe, but also because that this would complete the whole picture of Euro-Atlantic integration, not just in the Western Balkans, but also further on, because Turkey has been a member of Euro-Atlantic institutions since 1952. So I think for the U.S., it wasn't just about embracing the Islamic world, but to complete this Euro-Atlantic integration process. But recently, of course, with this speech, Barack Obama, President Obama, has actually tied it more closely to this embracing of the Islamic world. And that's quite meaningful. And I think here the Europeans have to think about, you know, what kind of a Europe they want in the future. You know, the accession negotiations have started, and if they end with Turkey not joining, it will be the very first case where an accession negotiation started that didn't conclude in full membership, and it will be the only country that has an Islamic population. So it'll actually look very bad. So I think that was his message.
Well, so you've raised the stakes there. I mean, if Turkey's membership goes awry, if the application goes awry, I'm wondering, is there any expectation on the part of Turks and the Turkish administration that Barack Obama himself deliver on this support for EU membership? Or is it perfectly fine that Barack Obama says, well, we tried as hard as we could, but, you know, you couldn't get the votes?
Well, I mean, there's just so much the United States can do, really, because as President Sarkozy said that, you know, it is an EU matter. Obviously, I mean, in terms of transatlantic relations, which are also in the remaking, it really depends how the United States further develops those relations with old Europe. So it really depends on what kinds of bargains are made there. But I think in the short run, the Europeans, particularly France and Germany, are not likely to budge from their position of being skeptical towards Turkey's EU membership. But that remains to be seen.
All right. Finally, I can't resist asking you, what do you think the opportunity is for Michelle Obama, one of the most popular women in the world right now, who, you know, took Europe by storm last week? And has at least the potential of making some sort of very implicit but influential messages to women in the Muslim world. What do you think?
Well, I think not just in the Muslim world, but women everywhere.
Of course.
I mean, she's obviously, you know, quite a strong first lady who actually has, you know, a successful career herself. But also, I mean, her warmth and elegance. She's already won everybody over in Britain when she actually visited the school and everything. So, I think definitely as a model, it can only have positive repercussions.
All positive from Dr. Gulnar Aybet. Thanks for joining us. She's a specialist on Turkey at the University of Kent in the UK and working on a book called Turkey and the Trend. Transatlantic bargain, time to renegotiate. She joined us from London. Mark Garrison is here with the headlines now.
Thank you, John. It's 28 minutes after the hour. A powerful earthquake struck central Italy overnight, killing at least 50. Many others are trapped. The quake was centered about 70 miles northeast of Rome. Thousands are now homeless. Rescuers are looking through the rubble for survivors. In Japan, the finance minister says he's going to announce an additional $100 billion stimulus plan Friday. The move comes as Bank of Japan policymakers gather for a two-day interest rate review. Sticking with business, talks between IBM and computer company Sun Microsystems have broken down. IBM had been planning to acquire Sun for about $7 billion. Also, we're going to talk about baseball in just a minute, but we can talk basketball first. College basketball will get a new championship tonight. The men's championship game pits Michigan State versus North Carolina. North Carolina is favored to win, but Michigan State obviously has, for emotional reasons, a lot of people rooting for that. Going to give that state a win after all the trouble with the car industry there.
Positive headlines for Michigan. Poor Michigan.
We'll see. We'll see. Also, the women play tomorrow night. That's where Connecticut is going to take on Louisville. If you'll remember, Louisville beat Oklahoma to advance, so that means OU star center Courtney Paris owes her school about $64,000. She guaranteed the university a championship, or else she would refund her scholarship money. She says she'll pay up.
UConn is unstoppable. 38 and zip.
38 yeah, yeah. And double-digit wins. Yeah.
Incredible. Thank you, Mark.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
As you can probably hear this morning, I would love to take a pill to just clear my head completely out. But let's talk neuroscience for a moment. Later on in the program, we're going to be talking about the frontiers of neuroscience, coming up with drugs that can actually selectively edit memories, enhance certain ones, eliminate other ones. What drug do you wish existed to tweak your brain and make your life better?
John, Dartmouth, Mass. My pill would allow me to admit when I'm wrong publicly and not feel bad about it.
You need a pill for that? Well, tell us your prescription wish at 8778-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
Well, there's snow forecast in Cincinnati and Philadelphia. It's the first week of April. It must be opening week for the baseball season. Of course, my focus is on Michigan State in Detroit playing the finals against University of North Carolina, and the women's game is also set. March Madness comes to an end at the beginning of April, but baseball begins this week. Hard to believe, and takeaway tailgater Jeff Beresford Howe has been doing some research on baseball bargains and what the recession has meant for the nation's pastime. Jeff, thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
It seems to me, at the very least, that this dark economic time that we're going through has widened the disparity between the teams that have it all financially and the teams that are really struggling. Is that your view of the situation?
Yeah, there are about nine sort of halves in baseball right now, and four or five or six of them are going to make the playoffs, and only one or two of the remaining 21 teams are going to make the playoffs this year. It's the year that baseball doomsayers have been looking forward to darkly for quite some time now.
Now, first of all, let's talk about the teams that are actually, tipping the hat to fans and offering financial incentives to come out to the ballpark.
Oh, there are deals all over Major League Baseball this year. The Los Angeles Dodgers, $25 gets you four tickets and all you can eat in the right field pavilion. Kansas City Royals, buy two season tickets, get two season tickets free. Texas, one half off for all games in April and May. And no fan out there is going to believe this, but it's true. In Arizona, the $4 beer is back.
Wow. But wait a minute. In Kansas City, buy two season tickets, get two season tickets for free?
That is exactly right.
That is a monster. And, of course, the Yankees, what deal are they offering?
That would be nothing at all.
Nothing at all. Red Sox?
Nothing at all.
Nothing at all, I see.
The Chicago Cubs, nothing at all.
That's so annoying. How can they do this? I mean, you hear on sports radio here in New York a lot of anger, but is there anything economically that will cause these teams to be held accountable?
Well, yeah, sure. Fans don't show up for the games. I mean, already the Yankees and the Mets have both sort of ratcheted down expectations a little bit by saying that they do expect that some of the more expensive seats at Yankee Stadium, $2,500 a shot seats, will be unfilled. And when you watch games this spring, you're going to see a lot of empty seats in those premium seats. But they're new stadiums, first year. Teams generally do everything they can to soak every dollar out of fans in the first couple of years of a new stadium, and New York fans are just going to have to sit and wait.
And Yankees and Mets, new stadiums, and there's all kinds of talk of, which one is more authentic. The Yankees is a kind of a money machine. The Mets Citi Field is a bit of an emblem of the financial crisis with Citibank on the logo there, but it's a beautiful pavilion.
It looks nice, but it's kind of astonishing to me that the Mets accepted over $600 million in funding for the stadium and can't be bothered to return the $400 million that Citi is supposed to give them for naming rights that are, in fact, now is being paid by you and me.
Yeah, we own it. It's just another thing that we own. All right, let's talk baseball for a minute. The Red Sox and the Tampa Bay Rays, this will be the main race, it seems to me, with the Yankees, playing catch-up in the American League East. Is Tampa Bay for real?
Oh, yes. They have just talent coming out of their ears. I mean, they sent down David Price to the minor leagues, the kid who pitched so well in the playoffs last year. And while certainly financial considerations are part of that, they also just don't need him. They have so much talent. They're the only team I can think of in baseball that could have sent down a kid as talented as David Price and not skipped a beat.
Why does the Boston Red Sox, in your view, not get a bump because Ortiz isn't doing as well? He ended the season poorly. Manny Ramirez is gone. You still think the Red Sox are a lock for the top of the AL East?
They are a lock for the playoffs. Tampa Bay possibly could beat them out in the AL East, although I don't think so. But, yeah, of all the wealthy teams, they're by far the best and most thoughtfully managed. And they've got a lineup that's solid 1-9. They've got a rotation that's solid. Their bullpen is solid. They just don't have any weaknesses.
And the Yankees, Joe Girardi loves this team, but do you?
No. They are one injury away from disaster. The A-Rod thing is gonna bite them all season long. The kind of injury he has tends to involve very slow, painful rehab, and players typically do not come charging back onto the field with it. So No, I see the Yankees missing the playoffs again.
All right, let's talk National League. Do the Phillies have a chance to repeat, or do we move west for the possible resurgence of the Dodgers?
The Dodgers are going to be very good this year. The Phillies are unlikely to repeat unless Cole Hamels turns out not to be injured. The other team you want to look at west is the Arizona Diamondbacks. They, like the Rays, have a ton of talent. And the front of their starting rotation, Brandon Webb and Danny Heron, is the best in baseball.
And they got the $4 beer.
And they got the $4 beer, so their fans should be happy. Also, $5 beers in Texas.
So is there any sort of general sense that the recession will help baseball? Back in the 1930s, it certainly did during the Great Depression. Economics very, very different now. But what's your supposition about box office throughout the league this year?
Well, what you see is that the wealthier teams, all the teams in the American League East, several of the teams in the National League East, are doing essentially nothing to deal with the recession. But around the rest of the country, you're seeing teams trying all kinds of creative things. The Pirates are offering fans layaway plans. Colorado is offering fans $6 tickets and season tickets in the lower deck on Tuesday nights for men and Wednesday nights for women, which is bizarre.
It's going to be a Colorado-Kansas City series. That's the way. We'll see by the end of the season if any of this works. Jeff Beresford Howe, Takeaway Tailgater, talking about sports in the opening week of the baseball season this week in 2009. Mark Garrison has some headlines, but the big sports story isn't baseball, right?
Basketball is tonight, but we'll be watching that. I know you're rooting for Michigan State, the underdogs. Also, looking abroad, President Obama's trip to Turkey continues. Right now, he's speaking to Turkish Parliament. A little bit later, he meets with the country's prime minister. North Korea's missile test may be over, but global fallout continues. The launch triggered an emergency UN Security Council meeting, but countries split on how to respond. The U.S. and U.K. want a strong resolution. China and Russia feel being too harsh on North Korea would make things worse. The global stock market rally is now into its fifth straight week. Asian markets closed up this morning. Hong Kong leads the way. Its key index up more than 3%. European markets more mixed this morning. Also, more than 30 dead and more than 100 hurt after a string of bombings ripped through several parts of Baghdad. John.
I didn't realize that. That's an amazing story. Thank you, Mark.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. This morning in Italy, the earth moved at 3:30 local time, an earthquake measuring at least 5.8 on the Richter scale, and some measurements put it at 6.3, hit a significant earthquake by any measure. At least 50 people have died. Tens of thousands of people are homeless. The damage is being assessed by rescue workers and journalists all over the area. Rachel Donadio joins us from our partner, The New York Times. She's the Rome bureau chief. She's in L'Aquila, Italy. Rachel, first of all, what's it feel like on the ground right at this moment?
Hi, John. Well, just a second ago, there was a little aftershock just while I was waiting to talk to you. Nothing certainly as big as the huge earthquake that hit at 3:30 in the morning. I was in Rome, 95 miles to the west, and was jolted awake when my entire house started shaking. Here, you can imagine, in L'Aquila, the center, the epicenter of the quake, things are much worse. This is in the Abruzzo region, a very mountainous region just to the east of Rome, and houses are destroyed. The cupola, the dome of the cathedral in the main downtown square, is half destroyed. There are a lot of other 18th and 17th and earlier century buildings that have huge cracks in them, rubble falling all over the place, roof tiles. I just did a little walk around in the historic center, treading lightly over rubble and hoping that things didn't shake again, but it looks pretty ugly. There's also another really tragic situation, which is that a university dormitory, which was about four stories high, collapsed you know, one floor collapsed into the other. It wasn't entirely flattened, but it looked really awful. And a lot of students and parents were waiting anxiously outside that dormitory, crying and comforting each other as rescue workers sifted through the rubble to try to find some of the students who are believed to be trapped inside.
Oh, horrible, reminiscent of the Northridge earthquake in California, where a dormitory was affected there. You know, we have images of rural towns clinging to mountainsides in Italy, and I'm wondering if that's the major challenge, seeing what the damage is like in the small communities outside of L'Aquila.
Yeah, I think that probably will be part of the challenge. I have heard that 26 surrounding towns have also had damage, and you just never know, I mean, whether the crack in the wall is going to lead to total structural collapse or not. A lot of post-war architecture around here, to my, you know, experienced eyes, does not look particularly sturdy. Some of these buildings don't inspire confidence. But then you look at some of the more ancient and even medieval structures that are built out of solid, solid stone and have withstood earthquakes in the past, and some of them aren't doing so well either. It's really hard to know what the situation will be. I heard the spokesman for Italy's Civil Protection Agency on television a little while ago, and he was saying that maybe even as many as 50,000 people would be homeless. L'Aquila, the seat of this area, has about 80,000 people altogether, and it's just hard to know who's homeless and who's not. The streets are filled with people in their pajamas carrying dusty suitcases as they try to collect some of their belongings and go stay with friends and relatives elsewhere.
But the government is moving into the area. The level of preparedness certainly exceeds the tragic earthquake in Naples in 1980, where the Italian government was seen to be not terribly prepared. Rachel Donadio from our partners, the New York Times, still feeling aftershocks there in L'Aquila, Italy, close to the epicenter. Rachel, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, John.
Again, the earth moved in the middle of the night in L'Aquila, Italy, central Italy. The earthquake measured at least 5.8 on the Richter scale.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Okay, fill in the blank. I would take a drug to tweak my brain to do blank and make my life better.
Kathy, Detroit, Michigan, and my prescription would fix my 4-year-old daughter's brain trauma so that she could live a normal life without epilepsy, cerebral palsy, and developmental delays.
The frontiers of neuroscience on the program this morning. Give us your suggestion for a brain to tweak your life and make it better, or maybe more than a tweak. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. More about that story in just a moment, right after headlines from Mark Garrison.
Thank you, John. It's 12 minutes before the hour. President Obama is speaking to Turkish Parliament right now. Just a moment ago, he spoke of the relationship between the U.S. and Turkey.
Trade between our nations has steadily advanced. So has cooperation in science and research. The ties among our people have deepened as well, and more Americans of Turkish origin live and work and succeed within our borders.
Next hour, the president meets with Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan. The number of car accident deaths in America is down last year. It hit its lowest point since 1961. Preliminary figures from the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration show just over 37,000 people died in crashes. Experts say it's partly due to the economic downturn. High gas prices have kept more people off the road. An 18-year-old ban on media coverage of returning American war dead ended last night. The family of a Virginia airman killed in Afghanistan allowed the media to watch his casket carried off the plane at Dover Air Force Base. Previously, the press had been banned to see that. A new Pentagon policy allows it, but only with family permission. John.
Thank you, Mark Garrison. So you may be aware of this, but we are on the frontier of a new science called neuroscience. It's a combination of microbiology, cell biology, and understanding of how neurons work. Also, the development of dramatic new tools for seeing the brain at work, and also the proliferation of computer technology that allows us to simulate what the brain, we believe, believe actually does. All of this means that scientists are suddenly able to think of memory and to think of brains as things that can be manipulated and changed. In the studio with me is New York Times science writer Ben Carey to talk about the possibility that one really important breakthrough in neuroscience that we're witnessing at this moment is the ability to use drugs to actually manage files in the brain, selectively eliminating bad memories or enhancing one's ability to remember. First of all, Ben, welcome.
Thanks very much.
And is, you know, this sounds kind of, you know, like a science fiction, but in fact, there is enough understanding of how the brain works to actually target memory centers of the brain. What is the chemistry that has suddenly suggested an actual pharmacological therapy?
Well, the first thing to say about this is there are no drugs to do the editing just yet, and there's ways to go to understand exactly how to do that. But there's some good progress being made on several fronts. I wrote a story today about which focused on one of those, a team in Brooklyn that's found a molecule which is active and seems to be very important for preserving or maintaining memories, all sorts of memories. And so when you interfere with that or you block the molecule, this is an animal work, the memories wash out. That suggests a whole range of things that could be possible. Now, it's a ways to go, of course, before you develop something like that into a drug.
But the interesting thing is that aside from simply the presence of this molecule, there seems to be an understanding of what it's actually doing, that in a sense, memories, particularly strong memories, are associated with neurons creating a sort of speed dial list for nearby neurons or groups of neurons, and that memories consist of a kind of a Facebook friend list of neurons that's established by experiences and then is difficult to break.
Yeah, that's a great metaphor for it. I think, the basic cell biology of memory, of just one cell communicating and to another and that neighboring cell or downstream cell preserving this memory has been around for a while. and by looking at that model, they've been able to develop some ideas of what's happening with the molecules when one stimulates a memory in another. And the way I see it, of course, memories are not just made up of two neurons or two cells, but a whole network of them. You sort of mentioned this Facebook idea. I sort of imagine one of these Christmas light displays where there are different traces going off and that each one of those is a kind of memory. And so what the researchers are trying to do, and they seem to be getting some traction, is to find out what's happening in the individual cells that keeps that whole network linked and sensitive to messages going through it. So that's the idea.
Well, Hollywood, of course, is way ahead of you here. Take a listen to this.
Why remember a destructive love affair? Here at Lacuna, we have perfected a safe, effective technique for the focused erasure of troubling memories. In a matter of hours, our patented non-surgical procedure will rid you of painful memories and allow you a new and lasting peace of mind you'd never imagined possible.
Now that's from the 2004 movie Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, actor Tom Wilkinson, suggesting that there's maybe a kind of, longing among people to actually have this kind of control over their brain if tools and therapies emerge from these exciting developments that you're talking about in the laboratory. What are the sort of ethical, social questions that we need to be concerned about?
Well, there are several. You can see where, from that clip, that there'd be a temptation to erase all sorts of painful memories. One of the disorders that is a particular target for this kind of thing was traumatic memories, sort of horrible memories that stalk people, that hang around, that are disabling. And that would be a therapeutic use. You try to blunt those memories and help them out, help them deal with the problem. However, in the clip, they're really talking about a memory that is more a part of life experience. It's painful, but it's perhaps something we learn from. Nonetheless, there'll be a temptation, I think, to erase those kinds of memories of breakups, memories when you've done bad things, even memories of crimes, for that matter. So wide availability of a drug like that would have this potential misuse. Yeah.
Is it possible that, I can imagine an application for a drug like this for people who experience trauma in war, and the upside would be that you prevent the disabling effects of really powerful, brutal memories. But there's also the argument that, well, if you blunt the intensity of war, the brutality of war, you actually eliminate an argument against it. You make it more likely that people will enter into war because the pain is dulled to a certain extent.
That's right. So you might in effect blunt or soften this collective memory of war, for that matter, the collective memory of many traumatic things. You might even argue that, for example, if a drug like this was used to wash out some cues and memories of addiction, that people might be tempted to, you know, to experiment more with drugs. So there is, of course, value in our memories, and so sort of starting to tinker with them has potential downsides that, you know, we don't even know yet, I think.
What about the restorative side? Is there anything in this research that suggests that memory can be recreated or retained in, say, for instance, an Alzheimer's patient where it's obviously deteriorating at a rate that, has severe psychological implications?
Well, that's the great hope. That's the big kahuna here, is that we can slow down age-related memory decline or treat or delay the onset of Alzheimer's disease. And, of course, I think everybody in this game, all the researchers who are working on this, are absolutely hopeful and optimistic and determined to make an impact with this research. And so, yes, I mean, that's the goal. That's really the biggest target of all.
And there's an enormous amount of money behind this research, true?
Yes, according to the Society for Neuroscience, the NIH spent more than $5 billion, about 20% of its budget last year, I believe that was last year's figures, on brain-related projects. That's the whole ton of money. And I think that part of this is due to the fact that, one thing is that these disorders of memory are big and getting bigger. More and more numbers of people are getting them as the population ages. But also, young people become excited about this field because it's still somewhat wide open. We're impressed by some of these findings, but there's just whole areas of the brain that are still dark, still waiting to be discovered.
So Ben Carey talking about new therapies to restore or selectively edit memory in the brain. NIH, 20% of its budget going to brain science. Thanks so much. He's a New York Times science writer here in the studio. What drug do you wish existed to tweak your brain and make your life better? Or would you take such a drug to begin with?
Hi, this is Elizabeth Tobier. Each pill we take involves pain and suffering and death for hundreds and thousands of test subject animals. I would not take any pill to change my mind because I love the Easter Bunny.
Your view at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. If you missed anything, we're always on here at The Takeaway. Take our podcast to go. You can subscribe at thetakeaway.org or iTunes. And the agenda is your takeaway.
His point is that if you anchor this Muslim nation into Europe, that says more than anything else that we in the West are, in fact, as open to Muslim nations as we are to other nations. Eastern Europe had a lot of those same problems.
That's our friend, the New York Times' Marcus Mabry, talking about Barack Obama in Turkey. He's speaking right now to the Turkish parliament. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
Spartans take the Motor City. An unusual happy headline for a beleaguered Detroit as Michigan State gets a shot at the NCAA championship facing the North Carolina Tar Heels. Home court advantage, basketball stimulus package. Michigan means to make more magic. A three-pointer is up. It's good on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, Takeaway shoppers. It's Monday, April 6th. I'm John Huckenberry. Adoria Doji is away spending time with her new baby. And coming up this hour, we're going to discuss the implications of the North Korean rocket launch and also talk about the third state to allow same-sex marriage. Guess what? It's Iowa. Those stories coming up. First headlines. 50 people dead, hundreds more injured after a strong earthquake hit central Italy this morning. Firefighters are working to rescue people still trapped. Geophysicist Amy Vaughn says the area is still experiencing tremors.
There are a lot of aftershocks in this region, in the epicenter area, that are much smaller in magnitude, that is continuing to keep the area actively shaking, at least.
Early estimates put the quake at 6.3 on the Richter scale. President Obama is in Turkey today, where he's addressing the Turkish parliament. He reiterated the need for close relations with the West.
We must seek the strength of a Europe that is truly united, peaceful, and free. So let me be clear. The United States strongly supports Turkey's bid to become a member of the European Union.
President called Turkey an important U.S. ally in many areas, including the fight against terrorism. Mark Garrison, what else you got?
Good morning, John. The U.N. Security Council has ended an emergency meeting without agreeing on a response to this weekend's rocket test by North Korea. The U.S., France, and Britain wanted a strong resolution, but China and Russia urged restraint. South Korean officials say the rocket landed harmlessly in the sea, but it did travel twice as far as any other missile the North has tested. More than 30 are dead and more than 100 injured after a series of bombings in Baghdad. The explosions ended a period of relatively low violence in Iraq. The number of deaths has dropped significantly in recent months.
That's a big story with Barack Obama in the region.
Several bombing Shiite areas, so people are watching that. Also, a delegation of senior officials is in Afghanistan to discuss its upcoming elections. U.S. Special Envoy Richard Holbrook and Joint Chiefs Chairman Admiral Mike Mullen met yesterday with Afghan President Hamid Karzai. Later on, they'll go to Pakistan as well.
I admire your grammatical expertise. Every single newscast, you've been faced with a delegation of U.S. officials are in Afghanistan, and you said is. That's fantastic. That saves us some grammar.
Ignore
email.
The prepositional phrase. Yes.
The S&P went up 1% to close at 8:43. That's where it opens this morning. Scientists are working on a drug that could eliminate bad memories, possibly even improve your grammar. What grammar? What drug do you wish existed to tweak your brain and make your life better?
Hi, this is Peggy from Stanhope, New Jersey, calling. If there's a memory I could erase, it's how good that hot fudge sundae tasted.
That's one sort of diet drug, kind of an oblique way of addressing weight loss. So forget every bad thing that ever tasted good. Appetite suppressants. Tell us your dream prescription for brain tweaking at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. I would take a drug to tweak my brain to do blank to make my life better.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Star Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. We're pretty sure that out in space, this music is actually not being broadcast. They say in space, no one can hear you scream. But over the weekend, the North Koreans launched a missile that the North Koreans claim sent a satellite into orbit to broadcast music like this. Western observers, including the Pentagon, saying no satellite. In fact, the three stages of the missile have landed harmlessly in the Pacific Ocean. The Japanese second that assessment. But the point is, North Korea has demonstrated the ability to launch a missile capable of traveling as far as 1,900 miles or more. And joining us to discuss the significance of this and the significance of the very, very strong reaction to the North Korean news from the U.S. President Barack Obama, who's in Turkey this morning, is Brian Myers, researcher of North Korean ideology and propaganda at Dongseo University in Busan, and John Sudworth of our partners at the BBC. Both join us from Seoul, South Korea. John and Brian, thanks for being with us.
Sure thing.
It's a pleasure.
So, John, let's begin. What is the military capability as far as we're able to determine at this point, and who does it threaten? And certainly the reaction has been very, very strong. We'll talk about that in a moment. John?
Well, I guess it depends who you believe. If you believe North Korea, which, as you say, predictably has already announced the success of its satellite launch, it says that the object is now in orbit, broadcasting revolutionary melodies. then I guess you'd have to say it's a pretty significant achievement. But the U.S. military, which was closely monitoring this launch, has deemed it to be a failure. It says it splashed down somewhere in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. And it seems, on that evidence, to have traveled about 3,000 kilometers. So, in one sense, it's a failure, but at least North Korea, I guess, in a military sense, has demonstrated that it has rocket technology capable of sending an object weighing possibly around 100 kilograms, at least that far. And I think some observers will say that that does enhance its military threat above what we knew it to have already.
Although 100 kilograms is far below the payload you'd need for any sort of nuclear warhead. We'll talk about that in a moment. Brian Myers, is it the case, and we've been through this on a number of times in the past, that the strong Western reaction to what happened today is itself a success in terms of the propaganda victory for the North Koreans?
I think so. I think it is a success because, remember, the failure to launch a satellite into orbit is not such a big problem for the Kim Jong-il regime. The North Korean people is well aware of the handicap that its scientists are operating under by trying to develop a nuclear program in the face of world opposition. And, you know, the claim to be on the cutting edge of technology has never been a part of the regime's domestic propaganda. So I think despite the failure of the satellite launch, the Kim Jong-il regime can still make plenty of hay out of the fact that it stood up to the world, it defied the United States, and that the United States is raging as it always does and actually not doing anything significant. So I would agree with John Zedwood's assessment that this is a big success in propaganda terms for the Kim Jong-il regime.
So it would appear by both of your analyses that this statement from U.S. Ambassador to the U.N., Susan Rice, over the weekend simply plays into that narrative. Listen.
The first resolution that is really the operative one was from 2006 when the North Koreans launched a missile and the United Nations Security Council demanded a halt to future missile-related activity and any future missile launches. We feel very strongly that what occurred today was a violation of that resolution. So we will go back and work to both toughen existing regimes, but to add to that resolution.
So that was Susan Rice speaking on ABC over the weekend. John Sudworth, does the UN Security Council, first of all, have the ability to compel North Korea to do anything here? And does the procedural battles in the Security Council simply enhance this notion that North Korea is defying the world that's trying to hold it back?
Well, I think if there was the possibility of a unified response, then I think North Korea would feel stung by that. But I suppose diplomatically, you have to say it's calculated correctly here. I think the kind of statement you heard from Susan Rice there was exactly the sort of thing that Washington was saying in the run-up to this launch. North Korea will have expected to have been condemned for doing this, but I think it will have also calculated that the possibility of China and Russia coming on board with any sort of agreement for punishment that would mean anything was extremely unlikely. China, of course, is a long-standing ally of North Korea. It may have calculated that this launch is now a done deal. It's failed, at least in the sense of trying to put a satellite into orbit. And the value of provoking this prickly and potentially nuclear-armed state on its border any further just isn't in Chinese interest.
Brian Myers, how do the North Koreans portray the fact that the Russians and certainly the Chinese are likely to assist it in the Security Council? Do they specifically note that the Chinese are bailing the North Koreans out, or is it a much more general view?
It's a much more general view. The North Koreans basically do not acknowledge China's role in foreign policy at all, or Russia's for that matter. They like to portray the conflict as a conflict between North Korea on the one hand and America and certain impure elements inside the UN on the other. So North Korea shies away from condemning the UN as a whole, but at the same time it makes clear that it does not respect the UN. It does not consider the UN's resolutions to be binding in any way.
Now, we've seen again and again around the world that the development of nuclear technology and missile technology produces an enormous propaganda, positive story in the sense that here is a nation joining the powerful larger nations in the world. But is there any strategic significance to this capability, Brian Myers, at all?
I don't think there is much of a strategic sense to it because, you know, the main goal of the North Korean regime is to get the Americans out of South Korea. And it's already, even before all these nuclear tests, it was in the position with its conventional weapons to destroy Seoul, as it has kept reminding South Korea for the past 10 or 15 years. So I don't really think that it changes the strategic ball game quite so much. But it does, I think, sort of usher North Korea into the nuclear club. We have to remember that even though it did violate UN Security Council Resolution 1718, North Korea did handle the actual launch with a measure of respect for international norms and procedures that we don't usually associate with a country. It announced the launch well in advance. It announced public hazard zones. And most importantly, it gave everyone a time frame, and it fired the missile within that time frame. And I think all of this has made it more difficult for North Korea's critics to claim that it was some reckless attempt to destabilize the region. I think we're seeing North Korea trying to behave now like a dignified nuclear power.
Well, those are interesting details, and I'm grateful, Brian Myers, that you pointed them out to us because it does set this into context. John Sudworth, I'll put it to you. What can North Korea do this week that it couldn't do last week based on this demonstration?
Well, I'd agree with Brian. Probably very little in the immediate analysis. I think longer term, there will be those who worry that this is yet another, albeit small, step towards the day where North Korea may well be able to deliver a warhead over a long distance and possibly a nuclear-armed one. We don't yet know with any certainty exactly what the level of development of North Korea's nuclear weapons capability may be. But I think in general terms, what's interesting here is that this is a deeply impoverished state, a highly reclusive country that struggles to feed its own people, and yet here it is attempting to join the club of space-faring nations with a launch that by some estimates would have cost them $300 million. There's no doubt about it. They saw this as a very important step and well worth spending the money on. And as you've heard from Brian, probably one of the main motivations is the message that it gives to its own people, a sort of gun salute, if you like, to the technological prowess of the leadership.
Brian Myers, last word in the last few seconds that we have. South Korean reaction, is that an indicator in any way of how critical the South Koreans view this?
Well, the South Koreans do not view it very critically, I think. We always have this pattern in South Korea. The initial South Korean response to North Korean provocations is usually very disapproving. But when the rest of the world piles onto North Korea, nationalism starts to make itself felt, and the South Koreans start to express sympathy for North Korea. There's already a lot of people in the South Korean press saying that Japan was making a big fuss about nothing. So I think that, you know, the South Korean disapproval of the North Korean missile launch will be very quick to fade.
Well, you may not be able to hear it from space, but the North Korean propaganda music, if it's not coming from a satellite, is definitely echoing around the world. Brian Myers is a researcher of North Korean ideology and propaganda at Dongseo University in Busan, and John Sudworth of our partners, the BBC, both joined us from Seoul, South Korea this morning. In space, they can't hear you scream, but the North Koreans can hear this music. They supposedly launched a satellite over the weekend that's broadcasting this in space. Western, Japanese, and Pentagon officials say no, the missile landed harmlessly in the Pacific Ocean. So, we are talking all this morning about what if there was a drug that you could take to tweak your brain and to make your life better.
Josh, Detroit, Michigan. My perfect pill, it's where it neutralizes all the adverse effects that industrial chemicals have put on my body.
What's your suggestion? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. In advance of the Wall Street opening, futures have turned south, so it looks like a negative opening this morning. Also, oil trading down. Scientists working on a drug that could eliminate bad memories or prevent memory loss. Fill in the blank. What drug would you take to tweak your brain to make your life better?
Good morning. Troy Conley from North Dakota. I'd take three pills. One that would neutralize the part of the brain that craves immediate gratifications. Another one that strengthens the areas of the brain that register pleasure only for lasting long-term solutions of real substance. And the last one would make my brain modulate all incoming speech patterns to sound like perky young British women.
I'm Femi Okay.
We're just making your dream come true there, Troy, but thanks for sharing. I have to say that that's way too much information, buddy, but thanks for calling at 877-8MYTAKE or MYTAKE at thetakeaway.org. Over the weekends, Iowans were mulling over a court ruling that has made gay marriage legal in their state. On Friday, Iowa Supreme Court threw out a state law that states that marriage can only be between a man and a woman. The Hawkeye State now joins Massachusetts and Connecticut as the only places in the nation where same-sex marriages are legal. Critics inside the state are vowing to fight this.
We certainly are not discouraged today, even though the ruling did not go the way we feel it should go. Based on the word of God, we are going to continue to fight this thing.
That's the Reverend Keith Ratliff Sr., the pastor of Maple Street Missionary Baptist Church in Iowa. Joining us now is Joyce Russell, Statehouse reporter for Iowa Public Radio, who talked with that critic of the Supreme Court decision. Joyce, thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you.
Now, this Supreme Court decision is interesting in the sense that there's not an immediate challenge. People in Iowa are going to have to live with this ruling for some time. Explain.
Well, that's right. The court gives 21 days, and after that, gay and lesbian couples will be allowed to get married. This is a final ruling from the court, and the only avenue that critics have is a constitutional amendment. In Iowa, it's a much more complicated process than in some other states to amend the Constitution. A constitutional amendment to ban gay marriage would have to pass two successive general assemblies and then be put to a vote of the people. And the soonest that that could happen would be 2012. And gay and lesbian couples would be getting married in the meantime. Also, the Democratic-controlled legislature is in no hurry to even get that started.
Well, that's very, very interesting. And so I guess it explains this sense of relief from some of the people that you talked with last week. Listen to this individual, Chuck Swaggerty.
We have been together in sickness and health through the death of his mother, through the adoption of our children. Through four long years of this legal battle. And if being together through all of that isn't love and commitment, or isn't family, or isn't marriage, then I don't know what is.
Chuck Swaggerty, of course, one of the plaintiffs, one of the clients represented by the Lambda Legal Defense Fund in the case that was ruled on last week. Is it fair to say that there's relief all over the state among people who had wanted to get married but were prohibited by state law?
Oh, yes, just as was the case in the few other states who approved it. These six couples, I'm sure, will be the first at the door to apply for marriage licenses. But there was already a few people lining up, not realizing that this ruling would take 21 days to implement. Already people lining up at county recorder's office requesting marriage licenses the day the ruling came down.
Wow, so they still have 21 days maybe to sort out some other details. And, you know, weddings are complicated, so maybe that 21 days would be good. What are the long...
Well, you get the license, then you can plan your wedding.
There you go. What are the long-term political implications in the state? Does this break down east side of the state, west side of the state, cities versus rural?
No, I don't think so, but there's certainly some strong opposition. The latest poll showed 37% of Iowans oppose either gay marriage or civil unions. 26% approved gay marriage and 28% approved civil unions for gay and lesbian couples. However, because it now falls to the legislature to get a constitutional amendment rolling, I'm sure that this is going to energize the Republican base significantly and that there will be a concerted effort in the next election to elect lawmakers who will let a constitutional amendment go through the legislature and then come up for a vote of the people. What's interesting to me about this is just in the meantime, there are going to be gay and lesbian couples getting married. And what I think is going to be extremely interesting to watch is how, once that gets going here, what effect is that going to have on public opinion? Is that going to energize even more the opponents of gay marriage, or is it going to regularize gay marriage in a way that's going to take the edge off the opposition?
Well, it's so interesting because it's very different from how this played out in California, where there was a ruling and then there was an energizing of the opposition, but it was in the mm-hmm. middle of a presidential campaign. 2012 will be in the middle of another presidential campaign.
That's true.
But the 3 years, in the intervening time, a whole lot could happen. The suspicion is it's not going to play out the way it did in California, it sounds like you're saying, Joyce.
Right. And we have to stress that 2012 would be the absolute soonest. That assumes that this Democratic-controlled legislature, two-year General Assembly, lets this constitutional amendment go through, and there's every indication that they won't. And then that would push it back even further than 2012.
So if that happened, then it would be happening outside of an election cycle, and there wouldn't be the benefit of the enormous numbers of people coming to the poll really skewing results. It would be a single-issue ballot measure mm-hmm. or a single-issue kind of effort, and that would be very, very different than California.
It would be in an election year, but not a presidential election year. You're right.
Well, Joyce Rushell, State House reporter for Iowa Public Radio, thanks for joining us on Friday. The Supreme Court in Iowa threw out a state law that said marriage could be only between a man and a woman. Iowa now joins Massachusetts and Connecticut, where same-sex marriages are legal. Mark Garrison now has some headlines.
Thank you, John. 28 minutes after the hour, President Obama is meeting with Turkish Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Earlier today, he spoke to Turkish Parliament. The president looked toward neighboring Iran.
Iran is a great civilization. We want them to engage in the economic and political integration that brings prosperity and security. But Iran's leaders must choose whether they will try to build a weapon or build a better future for their people.
The president also reiterated the need for closer ties between the U.S. and Turkey and firmly endorsed Turkey's bid for EU membership. He said the nation is an important U.S. ally in many areas. South Africa's top prosecutors say the court won't pursue corruption charges against presidential candidate Jacob Zuma. He faced the possibility of trial since 2003 when he was accused of accepting bribes to halt a probe into an arms company. He's considered a likely winner in the election later this month. Also in the U.S., the number of car accident deaths last year hit its lowest point since 1961. Preliminary figures from the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration show just over 37,000 people died in crashes. That's a big drop, and experts say high gas prices.
Bit of an economic indicator. Wall Street getting ready to open, and it's going to be down, according to the futures trading.
We'll
thank you, Mark.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Eliminate bad memories. Prevent memory loss. Go to our website right now, thetakeaway.org. Actually, we're not selling snake oil on our website. We're talking about the brave new world of neuroscience. It's a story in our partners, the New York Times. Would you take a drug to get rid of a memory? What drug do you wish existed to tweak your brain and make your life better?
This is Sylvia Soto, and I would definitely have anything done so that I could remember anything. I'm constantly forgetting everything.
Tell us your prescription wish list, 877-8-MY-TAKE. I would take a drug to do blank to tweak my brain. You can also register with us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. In Michigan, they probably think they took a pill to cause them to have smiles on all of their faces, an unusual set of fabulously positive headlines for the state of Michigan. In Detroit, it's a huge night. Oh, yeah. NCAA finals are pairing the North Carolina Tar Heels with the Michigan State Spartans. Well, how much of a dream is this? Listen to Michigan State Spartans coach Tom Izzo.
I just kind of looked up and said, this is
this can't be happening, you know. Not because we're going back to another Final Four. I mean, that's big enough. But to have it in your home state was something that you just dream about.
Well, the dream for the Spartans and all the Spartan fans there in Detroit has come true. But, you know, I detected a little less enthusiasm from the CBS announcers who were calling the game over the weekend.
So this can be an effective lineup with for UConn.
Price finds another seam. Robinson! Man open up ahead. Summers going to go ahead and take it in, and he's fouled, and the basket counts! Michigan State advances.
Yeah. Detroit is in all of our faces tonight. Tim Alberta joins us, Wall Street Journal reporter. He's a Spartans fan and is talking about the significance of these Final Four games in Detroit, in a city which hasn't had any good headlines in at least 5 years. He joins us from Washington. Tim, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, John. Good morning.
I mean, this is a dream come true for Michiganders and also Spartan fans. How much is this worth to the city of Detroit?
Well, you can't even put a dollar value on it, I don't think. It certainly is an incredible time right now for Detroit, kind of this Charles Dickens, you know, best of times, worst of times, except it's a tale of one city, you know, and really a tale of one state. You know, nobody really needs to talk too much about all the heartache in the state of Michigan right now with jobs lost across almost every industry, but this is certainly kind of a unifying moment for the state. You know, it's a special time when you have University of Michigan fans out in Ann Arbor even pulling for the Spartans. From what I hear from my friends down in Detroit, there was quite a few of the maize and blue down there that were even cheering for the team down the road, their arch rival Michigan State. So just based on that alone, you know it's got to be a pretty special time down there.
Now, Oldsmobile rolled up its factory in East Lansing, where the Michigan State campus is. So, you know, even Lansing is participating in this economic, sort of unifying moment. Is it really worth anything to the state, or, you know, tomorrow, day after tomorrow, it's back to, you know, the depressing business as usual?
Well, you know, you hear a lot of naysayers who want to kind of look at the glass half empty here and say, well, it's just one weekend, and even if it pumps, you know, 40 or 50 million into the economy, you know, the day after they leave, we'll be right back to losing more jobs and, you know, unemployment creeping higher and higher every day. But, you know, I think that's a really cynical way to look at it. As far as I'm concerned, one weekend is better than nothing. And when you talk to the people down in Detroit and the people around Michigan, you talk to the hospitality people who have opened up big fancy hotels in Detroit and who have not been getting the business that they were expecting, you know, one weekend can be huge. And as far as they're concerned, who knows? You know, maybe this could be the spark they've been looking for. Maybe this could be, you know, the beginning of kind of, you know, a lot of these guys in all the industries down there have struggled through the first quarter, and so they kind of look towards the spring and summer as a time to rebound. So I think that this could definitely be a jump start in some ways. Now, you know, we can't kid ourselves and say that one weekend of economic prosperity for Detroit is a cure-all for, you know, the many, many problems that it's facing. But it's a start, and it certainly is a welcome distraction for a town and a state that has had, like you said, just a steady drip of bad news over the last year.
Well, it's a heck of a lot better than all those Jeff Daniels commercials on the business networks. I mean, that's for sure. I mean, the magic could be back, sure. And literally Magic Johnson is going to be there throwing out the game ball at the game tonight. You know, the other narrative that's really interesting here that, you know, people outside of Michigan probably don't know is that, you know, if you look at Tom Izzo, okay, this is the Upper Peninsula coming down to save the LP, the Lower Peninsula. Explain.
That's right. Yeah, he is an Iron Mountain, Michigan native. He and Steve Mariucci, who is the former coach of the Detroit Lions, and Steve Mariucci was also supposed to be the savior of the Lower Peninsula, but that did not work out quite so well for him. But no, Tom Izzo has done a fantastic job. He is a Michigan man through and through. One of the best coaches in collegiate sports, runs a squeaky clean program, gets phenomenal recruiting classes every year, and he's been tempted many times by the NBA and surely by other big time college programs to leave, but I think this is his 14th year now at Michigan State. He is the dean of Big Ten coaches, and he is about as loved a public figure as there is in the state of Michigan.
So,
and when you're going up against people like Governor Granholm and Kwame Kilpatrick, that's saying quite a bit.
Yeah, indeed. Well, I mean, the idea that the UP would save the Lower Peninsula as someone who went to high school in western Michigan, that's of significance to me. Now, you know, finally here, do you have a prediction, and do you and your colleague Stefan Fatsis disagree over how this is going to turn out? Can you share that?
Well, to be honest with you, I actually, about 3 or 4 weeks ago when all this started, I had penciled in Michigan State and UNC into my into the championship in my bracket, and I had picked UNC. They are a pretty phenomenal squad. They have so much NBA-ready talent on there, but it's hard to look at Michigan State and the way they've been playing recently and not think that they are a team of destiny in some way. Obviously, a lot of people know that these two teams played in early December on this same court at Ford Field, and a lot of people looked at that as a possible finals preview, but UNC won that game by 30 points, and a lot of people came away kind of unsure about Michigan State's ability. But this is a totally different team, totally different game, totally different atmosphere, and I would not be surprised whatsoever if Michigan State was able to come in and pull the upset. And actually, I'm kind of expecting it. I think this could be a magical night for for the city of Detroit and the state of Michigan.
And he called it 4 weeks ago. Tim Alberta, you must be a fabulously wealthy person if you won the bracket there. Tim Alberta, Wall Street Journal reporter, following the Michigan State Spartans as they go up against the North Carolina Tar Heels tonight in Detroit. Thanks, Tim.
Yeah, thanks for having me, John.
And thanks to Eminem. Ooh, man. Marcus Garrison has our headlines.
Thank you. 20 minutes before the hour, the UN Security Council is deadlocked over what to do about North Korea's missile test. An emergency meeting yesterday essentially went nowhere. Countries differ on whether to pass a strong resolution. More than 30 Iraqis are dead and well over 100 more injured in Baghdad. A string of bombings there hit mostly Shiite areas. Also, an 18-year-old ban on media coverage of returning American war dead that ended last night. John?
Thank you, Mark.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Disturbing story this morning out of Baghdad. 6 car bombs exploding, more than 30 people dead in and around Baghdad. Joining us now is New York Times Baghdad correspondent Stephen Lee Myers in Baghdad. Stephen, first of all, what are the claims of responsibility, if any? And this seems to be a very disturbingly timed attack with Barack Obama speaking in Turkey, even at this hour.
The one thing is there haven't been any claims of responsibility, which is often the case. In fact, there's not really a clear pattern at all. I'm not sure you could attribute it directly to what was happening in Turkey today or Obama's visit generally.
But in general, I mean, it has been the case that Baghdad has been peaceful. What explains all of these attacks on this particular day? You say there have been no claims of responsibility. Were law enforcement officials, really taken by surprise here?
You know, in the last couple of months, there have been periodic outbreaks of violence with large bombings, or like today, which was unusual to have so many at once. The interesting thing is the Iraqi officials couldn't seem to agree on what was behind it or even who was behind it. Everybody seemed to have a different theory, whether or not it was remnants of al-Qaeda, whether or not it was Sunni groups which had been in conflict with the government recently over pay, whether it was loyalists to the old regime. Everybody seems to have a different theory.
Well, that chaos likely to discredit the government further as, Iraqis grapple with the political challenges ahead. But it appears as though the greatest death toll was in the Shiite neighborhood near the Ariba Market in Sadr City. Do you have a sense of what actually happened and how people are dealing with this at this hour?
There's a lot of anger. Most of the bombings appeared targeted in Shiite neighborhoods. There was one, an assassination attempt against a Ministry of Interior official. Those are the kinds of attacks that we see more often. But to have this many, there does seem to have been an attempt to target Shia areas. And
you know, at the scene of two of them, there was obviously a lot of anger, some of it directed at the Americans and the government forces for not providing security, some of it directed, as I said before, at Al-Qaeda or the former Ba'athist party of Saddam Hussein. I think that the goal of these attacks do seem to be to sow chaos, to discredit the government, and the government itself seems very sensitive to that today. One member of the parliament talked about how this was a final grasp of insurgents to try to wreak havoc, but that they wouldn't succeed.
And, you know, we should point out it's been, you know, during the worst of the violence, when things began to lull, it was Sunni attacks on Shiite targets that really caused things to erupt again. So really what we're seeing is a test of whether that can happen again.
I think that's right. I mean, the fact of the matter is that violence still is much lower than it was at the worst. But these kinds of attacks have increasingly in recent months drawn the attention of the Americans and the Iraqi officials, who see it as a regrouping, perhaps, of insurgents against the government.
Well, the test is, we are seeing the challenge this morning. New York Times Baghdad correspondent Stephen Lee Myers in Baghdad reporting on 6 car bombs exploding in or around Baghdad, killing more than 30 people. Death count still rising.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Mark Garrison, think fast. I say Rwanda, you say?
We'd probably say genocide.
There you go. So. The challenges of a nation rebranding itself as an investment possibility. When we come back, first headlines from Mark Garrison.
Thank you. It's 12 minutes before the hour. President Obama is in Turkey today meeting Turkish leaders. He'll go next to Istanbul. Earlier today, he spoke to the Turkish parliament. The president acknowledged that the relationship between the U.S. and Turkey has sometimes been rocky.
I know that the trust that binds the United States and Turkey has been strained. And I know that strain is shared in many places where the Muslim faith is practiced. So let me say this as clearly as I can. The United States is not and will never be at war with Islam.
The president said Turkey is an important U.S. ally in many areas, including the fight against terrorism. U.S. Special Envoy Richard Holbrooke travels to Islamabad today. He'll meet with Pakistani leaders to talk about targeting militants there. He met with Afghan President Hamid Karzai earlier to discuss the upcoming Afghan election and regional security. Pakistan's newly reinstated Chief Justice Iftikhar Chowdhury has ordered a police committee to investigate the videotaped flogging of a teenage girl in northwest Swat Valley. The Taliban apparently ordered the beating. The justice says it's a cruel violation of fundamental rights.
The political significance of that is really, really interesting. Yes,
he's new in that job.
He's reinstated, that's for sure. Thank you, Mark Garrison. So 15 years, the word Rwandan has been an adjective for genocide. 15 years ago, intertribal slaughter in Rwanda killed an estimated 800,000 Tutsis and politically moderate Hutu. But what's happened since then? Is there a way for Rwanda to separate itself from the reputation of so much tragedy? Joining us in the studio is Jeff Chu, senior editor with Fast Company magazine. In the current issue, he has a story called Rwanda Rising. It explores Rwandan President Paul Kagame's aggressive attempts to court Western investors and to directly, nation-to-nation, turn Rwanda from an impoverished nation with a brutal reputation into a popular, powerful brand and a locus for global investment from around the world. Jeff, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Now, what is the model here for Rwanda? Is it Vietnam or you know, other economic tigers that have emerged from the developing world and unlikely to a certain extent?
President Kagame likes to talk about Singapore. I don't know that there's really a great model.
out there. This is something that really hasn't been tried before. Other countries haven't been as poor as Rwanda, and nobody has this tragic story, and nobody's tried to do it so quickly either.
So what are the limitations then on the surface for Rwanda, and how has President Kagame attempted to get around them?
You know, it's a tiny country. It's the size of Vermont, but it's got tons and tons more people. It's landlocked. It doesn't have access to ports. Kagame has tried to take care of this problem by reaching out to investors in the U.S. He spends a lot more time in Boston and Austin and Seattle courting CEOs than he does begging for aid like most African leaders do.
Well, and you get the sense that the things are actually happening. Here is Dr. Elian Ubujaru. She's a professor at McGill University and an advisor to President Kagame, and talks somewhat predictably about what's going on in the country.
I come to Rwanda probably about four times a year, and every time I come, I notice something new. I notice better service at the airport. I notice new buildings going up. I notice new businesses coming. I notice new programs within the countryside that are looking at ways to bring value to agriculture and get more money coming to farmers.
Now, was that your impression, Jeff, when you were in Rwanda for the period for this article?
Definitely in the city. I like to say that Kigali is Africa that Americans can handle. You have the Wi-Fi, as you said. There's a 24-hour supermarket. The streets are clean. It's well landscaped. But if you go outside of the city, it's more like Africa that you would expect from the pages of National Geographic. You see the babies with the distended tummies. You see the malarial mothers. You see a lot of the poverty, and that's the big problem for Rwanda.
So what is Kagame offering investors? Natural resources? Probably not. Rwandan manufacturing markets at a lower wage scale than, say, China? I wonder.
I would say he's offering a lot of hope right now. They have coffee. They have pretty good coffee that they sell in Starbucks and in Costco, and that's brought a lot of foreign income into the country. They don't have any resources to speak of, but what he's trying to do is to develop a high-tech hub. He's working on education. They've got internet access. It's going reasonably well.
Well, listen to Alex Kanyakole, who's the head of the Rwanda Coffee Development Authority in Kigali. He sort of lays out what the challenge is right here.
We need it to be sold as a brand, not as a commodity coming from anywhere or which can come from anywhere, because this is what really gives us a competitive and a distinctive advantage in the market.
So how do you rebrand Rwanda, in the case of what this source is talking about, coffee, as something separate from all the instability that Rwanda has come to represent?
To be frank, I think it's going to take a lot of time. I think one reason that the brand of Rwanda appeals is that we like a winner. We like a comeback story, and that's what Rwanda is right now. It's an amazing comeback story over the last 15 years, and it's kind of banking on that. Over time, they're hoping the memories will fade and will develop a new image of Rwanda as a place where premium coffee comes from and where other good things come from. And that's what they're hoping for.
What investment is required to make good on some of these promises from the outside?
It's going to take tons and tons of investment from companies all over the world. I know that there's one German company that's raising a venture capital fund to invest in Rwanda. It's going to take that. They don't need our pity. They need our business. I think that's what's going to create jobs, and that's what's going to create a prosperous Rwanda.
But what you're describing is essentially a charitable venture when you're not really talking about markets in the sort of Vietnam model, the East Asian model. You're really talking about investing there because it's a good comeback story. That feels a little charitable to
me. I would disagree with that. You know, Costco went there to buy coffee because they had a good product to buy at a good price. It's been profitable for Rwanda, but it's also been very profitable for Costco. The CEO of Costco told me they would never have gone in there if it didn't make them a lot of money.
Now, does Costco sell Rwandan coffee as Rwandan coffee, or do they sell it as Costco Kirkland brand?
It's Kirkland Signature Rwandan Roast.
Really? That's interesting. Did they have to negotiate to get that language?
I think it's something that they chose to do because they knew that there was an appeal in the marketplace for the Rwandan brand. People know it, and again, they like to be part of a comeback story.
So beyond coffee, is there the tendency, the potential that, I mean, Rwanda borders Congo, and of course, the Democratic Republic of Congo, it has a serious problem with coltan, the natural resource that's used to create and manufacture cell phones. It's a conflict substance, a conflict resource. Is there any of the potential for that kind of problem inside Rwanda?
You know, Rwanda has a neighborhood problem. I like to think of it as a nice house in a bad neighborhood. And it's going to have to deal with some of those Congo issues. But on the whole, it's corruption-free, it's safe, and it's stable.
So is Rwanda a model for other sub-Saharan African nations or even African nations broadly as a whole?
That's what they're hoping to be. They're hoping to set a new model that doesn't depend on aid, that depends on trade and manufacturing and other forms of new industry. We'll see if they can make it happen.
Does President Kagame actually oppose the kinds of traditional aid that has come to places like Rwanda?
He's been one of the most outspoken African leaders on this. Last year at the genocide commemorations, he chided his countrymen, saying, "You should be ashamed that taxpayers in foreign countries are helping to pay for this country."
Now, does statements like that, as particularly if they're widely reported around the world, does that encourage investment?
Oh, for sure. It sets Rwanda apart from other African countries. It really changes the image of the country, and it makes it look like it's being proactive, it's thinking along new lines, and I think that really helps Rwanda.
So how unusual is it that the nation of Rwanda would be in a magazine called Fast Company?
I think one of the great things about it is that it is counterintuitive. You don't expect to have a happy story coming out of Africa, especially from a country that 15 years ago was such a basket case where so many people died.
Well, it is a great positive story and a lot of interesting sort of economic indicators that are counterintuitive to this recession, which we're told again and again has so many dire consequences for the developing world. Jeff Chu, senior editor at Fast Company magazine, thanks for being with us.
Thanks a lot.
So we're also following this interesting story by our partner, The New York Times. Scientists are working on a drug that could eliminate bad memories or prevent memory loss, kind of edit the files in your brain. Would you take a drug to get rid of a memory? Or what drug do you wish existed to tweak your brain and make your life better in some way?
Frankie Little, Detroit, Michigan. I'd like to tweak my brain to not sweat the big stuff.
That's good. We get a lot of calls on this one from Detroit. Tell us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. I would take a drug to do blank, to tweak my brain and make my life better. Here's your takeaway.
We have to remember that even though it did violate UN Security Council Resolution 1718, North Korea did handle the actual launch with a measure of respect for international norms and procedures that we don't usually associate with a country.
So if there's a way to launch a missile responsibly, North Korea did it. There is no satellite broadcasting North Korean ideology and propaganda from space, but Brian Myers, researcher of North Korean ideology and propaganda at Dongseo University in Seoul, had your takeaway this morning. If you missed anything like that interview with Brian Myers and the BBC's John Sudworth, you can take our podcast to go. Subscribe now at thetakeaway.org or on iTunes. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.